It very often is. This chapter focuses on a small set of spoken texts in which members of the community of Sibikyu express claims about themselves, their language, and the lands on which they live. The statements that interest me, which could be supplemented by a large number of others, are the following. The land is always stalking people. The land makes people live right. The land looks after us. The land looks after people. Annie Peaches, age 77, 1978. Our children are losing the land. It doesn't go to work on them anymore. They don't know the stories about what happened at these places. That's why some get into trouble. Ronnie Loopy, age 42, chairman, White Mountain Apache Tribe, 1978. We used to survive only off the land. Now, it's no longer that way. Now we live only with money, so we need jobs. But the land still looks after us. We know the names of the places where everything happened. So, we stay away from badness. Nick Thompson, age 64, 1980. I think of that mountain, called Tse Li Gai Da Sidile, white rocks lie above in a compact cluster, as if it were my maternal grandmother. I recall stories of how it once was at that mountain. The stories told to me were like arrows. Elsewhere, hearing that mountain's name, I see it. Its name is like a picture. Stories go to work on you like arrows. Stories make you live right. Stories make you replace yourself. Benson Lewis, age 64, 1979. One time I went to L.A. training for mechanic. It was no good. Sure, no good. I start drinking, hanging around bars all the time. I start getting into trouble with my wife, fight sometimes with her. It was bad. I forget about this country here around Sibikyu. I forget all the names and stories. I don't hear them in my mind anymore. I forget how to live right. Forget how to be strong. Wilson Lavender, age 52, 1975. If these statements resist easy interpretation, it is not because the people who made them are confused or cloudy thinkers. Neither is it because, as one unfortunate commentator would have us believe, the Western Apache are mystically inclined and correspondingly inarticulate. The problem we face is a semiotic one. A barrier to constructing appropriate sense and significance which arises from the fact that all views articulated by Apache people are informed by their experience in a culturally constituted world of objects and events with which most of us are unfamiliar. What sort of world is it? Or, to draw the question into somewhat sharper focus, what is the cultural context in which Apache statements, such as the foregoing, find acceptance as valid claims about reality? More specifically still, what is required to interpret Annie Peach's claim that the land occupied by the Western Apache is always stalking people, and that because of this, they know how to live right? How should we understand Chairman Lupi's assertion that Apache children sometimes misbehave because the land doesn't go to work on them anymore? Why does Nick Thompson claim that his knowledge of place names and historical events enables him to stay away from badness? Why does Benson Lewis liken place names to pictures, stories to arrows, and a mountain near Sibikyu to his maternal grandmother? And what should we make of Wilson Lavender's recollection of an unhappy time in California when forgetting place names and stories caused him to forget how to be strong? Are these claims structured in metaphorical terms, or are they, given Western Apache assumptions about the physical universe and the place of people within it, somehow to be interpreted literally? In any case, what is the reasoning that lies behind the claims, the informal logic of which they are simultaneously products and expressions? Above all, what makes the claims make sense? I shall address these and other questions through an investigation of how Western Apache talk about the natural landscape and the importance they attach to named locations within it. Accordingly, my discussion focuses on elements of language and patterns of speech, my purpose being to learn from these elements and patterns something of how Apache people construe their land and render it intelligible. Whenever Apaches describe the land, or, as happens more frequently, whenever they tell stories about incidents that have occurred at specific points upon it, they take steps to constitute it in relation to themselves, which is simply to observe that in acts of speech, mundane and otherwise, Apaches fashion images and understandings of the land that are accepted as credible accounts of what it actually is, why it is significant, and how it impinges on the daily lives of men and women. In short, portions of a worldview are constructed and made available, and a Western Apache view of the landscape is deepened, amplified, and tacitly affirmed. With words, a massive physical presence is fashioned into a meaningful human universe. The universe of meanings comprises the cultural context in which the Western Apache texts presented earlier acquire their validity and appropriateness. Consequently, if we are to understand the claims set forth in these statements, portions of that context must be explored and made explicit. We must proceed, in other words, by relating our texts to other aspects of Western Apache thought, in effect, to other texts and other claims, and continue doing this more and more comprehensively until finally it is possible to confront the texts directly and expose the major premises on which they rest. As we shall see, most of these premises are grounded in an unformalized native model of Western Apache storytelling, which holds that oral narratives have the power to establish enduring bonds between individuals and features of the natural landscape, and that as a direct consequence of such bonds, persons who have acted improperly will be moved to reflect critically on their misconduct and resolve to improve it. A native model of how stories work to shape Apache's conceptions of the landscape, it is also a model of how stories work to shape Apache's conceptions of themselves. Ultimately, it is a model of how two symbolic resources, language and the land, are manipulated by Apaches to promote compliance with standards for acceptable social behavior and the moral values that support them. Should it appear, then, that these Western Apache texts lack either substance or complexity, we shall see that, in fact, both qualities are present in ample measure. And should the aim of interpreting such modestly worded documents seem unduly narrow, or my strategy for trying to accomplish it too tightly bound up with an examination of linguistic and ethnographic particulars, it will become evident soon enough that wider and more general issues are very much involved. Of these, I shall suggest, none is more pressing or conspicuous than the reluctance of cultural ecologists to deal openly and in close detail with the symbolic attributes of human environments and the effects of environmental constructions on patterns of social action. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The problem now is how to get started, and for advice on that matter, I turn here, as I actually did in Cibicu a number of years ago, to a gifted and unusual man, teacher and consultant, serious thinker and salacious joker alike. He has so strongly influenced the content and organization of this essay that he has become, with his permission, a part of it himself, and so too of the interpretation it presents. Learn the names. Nick Thompson is, by his own admission, an old man. It is possible, he told me once, that he was born in 1918. Beneath snow-white hair cut short, his face is round and compact, his features small and sharply molded. His large, black, and very bright eyes move quickly, and when he smiles, he acquires an expression that is at once mischievous and intimidating. I have known him for more than 20 years, and he has instructed me often on matters pertaining to Western Apache language and culture. A man who delights in play, he has also teased me unmercifully, concocted humorous stories about me that are thoroughly apocryphal, and embarrassed me before large numbers of incredulous Apaches by inquiring publicly into the most intimate details of my private life. Described by many people in Cibicu as a true slim coyote, Mats Ose, Nick Thompson is outspoken, incorrigible, and unabashed. He is also generous, thoughtful, and highly intelligent. I value his friendship immensely. As I bring my Jeep to a halt on the road beside the old man's camp, I hear Nick complaining loudly to his wife about the changing character of life in Cibicu and its regrettable effects on younger members of the community. I have heard these complaints before, and I know they are deeply felt. But still, on this sunny morning in June 1980, it is hard to suppress a smile. For the image Nick presents, a striking example of what can be achieved with sartorial bricolage, is hardly what one would expect of a staunch tribal conservative. Crippled since childhood, and partially paralyzed by a recent stroke, the old man is seated in the shade of a cottonwood tree, a few yards from the modest wooden cabin where he lives with his wife and two small grandchildren. He is smoking a Salem cigarette and studying with undisguised approval the shoes on his feet, a new pair of bright blue Nike running shoes, trimmed in incandescent orange. He is also wearing a pair of faded green trousers, a battered brown cowboy hat, and a white T-shirt with Disneyland printed in bold red letters across the front. Within easy reach of his chair, resting on the base of an upended washtub, is a copy of the National Enquirer, a mug of hot coffee, and an open box of chocolate-covered donuts. If Nick Thompson is an opponent of social change, it is certainly not evident from his appearance. But appearances can be deceiving, and Nick, who is an accomplished singer and a medicine man of substantial reputation, would be the first to point this out. The old man greets me with his eyes. Nothing is said for a minute or two, but then we begin to talk, exchanging bits of local news until enough time has passed for me to politely announce the purpose of my visit. I explain that I am puzzled by certain statements Apaches have made about the country surrounding Cibicu, and I am eager to know how to interpret them. To my surprise, Nick does not ask what I have been told or by whom. He responds instead by swinging his arm out in a wide arc. "Learn the names," he says. "Learn the names of all these places." Unprepared for such a firm and unequivocal suggestion, it sounds to me like nothing less than an order. I retreat into silence. "Start with the names," the old man continues. "I will teach you like before. Come back tomorrow morning." Nodding in agreement, I thank Nick for his willingness to help and tell him what I will be able to pay him. He says the wage is fair. A few minutes later, as I stand to take my leave, Nick's face breaks suddenly into a broad smile, and his eyes begin to dance. I know that look well, and brace myself for the farewell joke that almost always accompanies it. The old man wastes no time. He says I look lonely. He urges me to have prolonged and abundant sex with very old women. He says it prevents nosebleeds. He says that someday I can write a book about it. Flustered and at a loss for words, I smile weakly and shake my head. Delighted with this reaction, Nick laughs heartily and reaches for his coffee and a chocolate-covered donut. I return to the old man's camp the following day and start to learn Western Apache place names. My lessons, which are interrupted by mapping trips with more mobile Apache consultants, continue for the next 10 weeks. In late August, shortly before I must leave Cibicu, Nick asks to see the maps. He is not impressed. "White men need paper maps," he observes. "We have maps in our minds." Western Apache place names. The study of American Indian place name systems has fallen on hard times. Once a viable component of anthropology in the United States, it has virtually ceased to exist. The inconspicuous victim of changing intellectual fashions and large amounts of ethnographic neglect. There are good reasons for advocating a revival. As early as 1900, Franz Boas, who was deeply impressed by the minutely detailed environmental knowledge of the Baffin Land and Hudson Bay Eskimos, suggested that one of the most profitable ways to explore the mental life of Indian peoples was to investigate their geographical nomenclatures. In 1912, Edward Sapir made the same point in more general terms, saying that Indian vocabularies provided valuable insight into native conceptions of the natural world and much that was held to be significant within it. Later, in 1934, Boas published a short monograph entitled Geographical Names of the Kwakiutl Indians. This essay is essentially a study of Kwakiutl word morphology, but it demonstrates beautifully Boas's earlier ideas concerning the Eskimos, that the study of place name systems may reveal a great deal about the cognitive categories with which environmental phenomena are organized and understood. The tradition of research, which also included J.P. Harrington's massive treatise on Tewa place names, began to falter in the years preceding World War II. A few brief articles appeared in the 1950s, and Floyd Lounsbury contributed an important paper on Iroquois place names in 1960. Since then, however, little work has been done. Indeed, with the notable exception of Frederica de Laguna's 1972 long-delayed monograph on the Tlingit, I know of not a single study written by a linguist or anthropologist in the past 25 years that deals extensively or in depth with the place name system of a North American tribe. One can only imagine how Boas or Sapir might have reacted to Nick Thompson's interest in Western Apache place names. They would have been intrigued, I think, but probably not surprised, for each of them had come to understand, as I would at Cibicu, that American Indian place names are intricate little creations and that studying their internal structure together with the functions they serve in spoken conversation can lead the ethnographer to any number of useful discoveries. All that is required is sound instruction from able native consultants, a fondness for mapping extensive areas of territory, and a modest capacity for wonder and delight at the large tasks that small words can be made to perform. And one more thing, a willingness to reject the widely accepted notion that place names are nothing more than handy vehicles of reference. Place names do refer, and quite indispensably at that, but in communities such as Cibicu, they are used and valued for other reasons as well. Located in a narrow valley, at an elevation of 4,900 feet, the settlement at Cibicu, from Deschi Biko, valley with long red bluffs, is bisected by a shallow stream, emanating from springs that rise in low-lying mountains to the north. Apache homes separated by horse pastures, agricultural plots, and ceremonial dance grounds are located on both sides of the stream for a distance of approximately 10 miles. The valley itself, bounded on the east and west by a series of red sandstone bluffs, displays marked topographic diversity in the form of heavily dissected canyons and arroyos, broad alluvial floodplains, and several clusters of prominent peaks. Vegetation ranges from a mixed ponderosa pine Douglas fir association near the headwaters of Sibicu Creek to a chaparral community consisting of scrub oak, catclaw, agave, and a variety of cactus species at the confluence of the creek with the Salt River. In between, numerous other floral associations occur, including dense riparian communities and heavy stands of cottonwood, oak, walnut, and pine. Together with Charles Henry, Morley Cromwell, and other Apache consultants, I have mapped nearly 45 square miles in and around the community at Sibicu, and within this area have recorded the Western Apache names for 296 locations. It is, to say the least, a region densely packed with place names, but large numbers alone do not account for the high frequency with which place names typically appear in Western Apache discourse. In part, this pattern of recurrent use results from the fact that Apaches, who travel a great deal to and from their homes, regularly call on each other to describe their trips in detail. Almost invariably, and in marked contrast to comparable reports delivered by Anglos living at Sibicu, these descriptions focus as much on where events occurred as on the nature and consequences of the events themselves. This practice has been observed in other Apachean groups as well, including, as Harry Hoyer noted, the Navajo. Even the most minute occurrences are described by Navajos in close conjunction with their physical settings, suggesting that unless narrated events are spatially anchored, their significance is somehow reduced and cannot be properly assessed. Hoyer could just as well be speaking of the Western Apache. Something else contributes to the common use of place names in Western Apache communities, however. And that, quite simply, is that Apaches enjoy using them. Several years ago, for example, when I was stringing a barbed wire fence with two Apache cowboys from Sibicu, I noticed that one of them was talking quietly to himself. When I listened carefully, I discovered that he was reciting a list of place names, a long list, punctuated only by spurts of tobacco juice, that went on for nearly 10 minutes. Later, when I ventured to ask him about it, he said he talked names all the time. Why? I like to, he said. I ride that way in my mind. And on dozens of other occasions when I have been working or traveling with Apaches, they have taken satisfaction in pointing out particular locations and pronouncing their names once, twice, three times or more. Why? Because we like to, or because those names are good to say. More often, however, Apaches account for their enthusiastic use of place names by commenting on the precision with which the names depict their reference. That place looks just like its name, someone will explain, or that name makes me see that place like it really is. Or, as Benson Lewis stated so succinctly, its name is like a picture. Statements such as these may be interpreted in light of certain facts about the linguistic structure of Western Apache place names. To begin with, it is essential to understand that all but a very few Apache place names take the form of complete sentences. This is made possible by one of the most prominent components of the Western Apache language, an elaborate system of prefixes that operate most extensively and productively to modify the stems of verbs. Thus, well-formed sentences can be constructed that are extremely compact, yet semantically very rich. It is this combination of brevity and expressiveness, I believe, that appeals to Apaches and makes the mere pronunciation of place names a satisfying experience. By way of illustration, consider the following place names, which have been segmented into their gross morphological constituents.
Tise bika tu yahil inye. Tise, rock, stone, plus bika, on top of it, a flattish object, plus tu, water, plus ya, downward, plus he, linear succession of regularly repeated movements, plus ni, it flows, plus ni, the one. Translation: water flows down on a succession of flat rocks.
Tis bitla tu oline.
Tis cottonwood tree.
Bitla, below it, underneath it.
Tu, water.
O,
inward.
The,
it flows.
Ni,
the one.
Translation: water flows inward under a cottonwood tree.
Tise hadgaie.
Tise, rock, stone, plus ha,
up and out,
plus d,
extends in a line,
plus gai,
white,
whiteness,
plus ye,
the one. Translation: line of white rocks extends up and out. Notice how thoroughly descriptive these place names are, and how pointedly specific in the physical details they pick out. The names presented here are not unique in this respect. On the contrary, as we have seen, descriptive specificity is characteristic of many Western Apache place names, and it is this distinctive attribute that causes Apaches to liken place names to pictures and to comment appreciatively on the capacity of place names to evoke full and accurate images of the locations to which they refer. But why this interest in faithful evocation? The reasons, no doubt, are multiple, but one of them is closely linked to the stylistic functions served by place names in Western Apache storytelling. Place names are used in all forms of Apache storytelling as situating devices, as conventionalized verbal instruments for locating narrated events at and in the physical settings where the events occurred. Thus, instead of describing these settings discursively, an Apache storyteller can simply employ their names, and Apache listeners, whether they have visited the sites or not, are able to imagine in some detail how they might appear. In this way, to borrow Hoyer's felicitous phrase, narrated events are spatially anchored at points on the land, and the evocative pictures presented by Western Apache place names become indispensable resources for the storyteller's craft. All these places have stories. When I return to Cibicue in the spring of 1981, Nick Thompson is recovering from a bad case of the flu. He is weak, despondent, and uncomfortable. We speak very little and make no mention of place names. His wife is worried about him, and so am I. Within a week, however, Nick's eldest son comes to my camp with a message. I am to visit his father and bring with me 2 packs of Salem cigarettes and 12 chocolate-covered donuts. This is good news. When I arrive at the old man's camp, he is sitting under the cottonwood tree by his house. A blanket is draped across his knees, and he is wearing a heavy plaid jacket and a red vinyl cap with white fur-lined ear flaps. There is color in his cheeks, and the sparkle is back in his eyes. Shortly after we start to converse, and apropos of nothing I can discern, Nick announces that in 1931, he had sexual intercourse 8 times in one night. He wants to know if I have ever been so fortunate. His wife, who has brought us each a cup of coffee, hears this remark and tells him he is a crazy old man. Nick laughs loudly. Plainly, he is feeling better. Eventually, I ask Nick if he is ready to resume our work together. Yes, he says, but no more on names. What then? Stories, is his reply. All these places have stories. We shoot each other with them, like arrows. Come back tomorrow morning. Puzzled once again, but suspecting that the old man has a plan he wants to follow, I tell him I will return. We then discuss Nick's wages. He insists that I pay him more than I did the year before, as it is necessary to keep up with inflation. I agree, and we settle on a larger sum. Then comes the predictable farewell joke, a fine piece of nonsense in which Nick, speaking English and imitating certain mannerisms he has come to associate with Anglo-physicians, diagnoses my badly sunburned nose as an advanced case of venereal disease. This time, it is Nick's wife who laughs loudest. The next day, Nick begins to instruct me on aspects of Western Apache storytelling, consulting on a regular basis with other Apaches from Cibicu as well. I pursue this topic throughout the summer. Historical Tales. If place names appear frequently in ordinary forms of Western Apache discourse, their use is equally conspicuous in oral narratives. It is there, in conjunction with stories Apaches tell, that we can move closer to an interpretation of native claims about the symbolic importance of geographical features and the personalized relationships that individuals may have with them. The people of Cibicu classify speech, Yati, into three major forms: ordinary talk, Yati, prayer, Oka Ahi, and narratives or stories, Nagodie. Narratives are further classified into four major and two minor genres. The major genres include myths, Godiigo Nagodie, literally, to tell of holiness, historical tales, Agodzahi or Agodzahi Nagodie, literally to tell of that which has happened, sagas, Nultego Nagodie, literally to tell of pleasantness, and stories that arise in the context of gossip, Chidi. The minor genres which do not concern us here are coyote stories, Mahekali Nagodie, literally to tell of coyote's travels, and seduction tales, Bini Ba'a Nagodie, literally to tell of sexual desires. Western Apaches distinguish among the major narrative genres on two basic semantic dimensions, time and purpose. Values on the temporal dimension identify in general terms when the events recounted in narrative took place, while values on the purposeful dimension describe the objectives that Apache narrators typically have in recounting them. Accordingly, myths deal with events that occurred in the beginning, Godiyana, a time when the universe and all things within it were achieving their present form and location. Performed only by medicine men and women, myths are presented for the primary purpose of enlightenment and instruction, to explain and reaffirm the complex processes by which the known world came into existence. Historical tales recount events that took place long ago, Do Anina, when the Western Apache people, having emerged from below the surface of the earth, were developing their own distinctive ways and customs. Most historical tales describe incidents that occurred prior to the coming of white men, but some of these stories are set in post-reservation times, which began for the Western Apache in 1872. Like myths, historical tales are intended to edify, but their main purpose is to criticize social delinquents, or, as the Apache say, to shoot them, thereby impressing these individuals with the undesirability of improper behavior and alerting them to the punitive consequences of further misconduct. Although sagas deal with historical themes, these narratives are chiefly concerned with events that have taken place in modern times, Diijigo, usually within the last 60 or 70 years. In contrast to historical tales, which focus on serious and disturbing matters, sagas are largely devoid of them. Rather than serving as vehicles of personal criticism, the primary purpose of sagas is to provide their listeners with relaxation and entertainment. Stories of the kind associated with gossip consist of reports in which persons relate and interpret events involving other members of the Western Apache community. These stories, which embrace incidents occurring now or at present, ka'ad, are often told for no other reason than to keep people informed of local developments. Not uncommonly, however, narratives in gossip are also used to ridicule and malign the character of their subjects. Nowhere do place names serve more important communicative functions than in the context of historical tales. As if to accentuate this fact, stories of the agudzahi genre are stylistically quite simple. Historical tales require no specialized lexicon, display no unusual syntactical constructions, and involve no irregular morphophonemic alternations. Neither are they characterized by unique patterns of stress, pitch, volume, or intonation. In these ways, agudzahi narratives contrast sharply with myths and sagas, which entail the use of a variety of genre-specific stylistic devices. Historical tales also differ from myths and sagas by virtue of their brevity. Whereas myths and sagas may take hours to complete, historical tales can usually be delivered in less than 5 minutes. Western Apache storytellers point out that this is both fitting and effective because agudzahi stories, like the arrows they are commonly said to represent, work best when they move swiftly. Finally, and most significantly of all, historical tales are distinguished from all other forms of Apache narrative by an opening and closing line that identifies with a place name where the events in the narrative occurred. These lines frame the narrative, mark it unmistakably as belonging to the agudzahi genre, and evoke a particular physical setting in which listeners can imaginatively situate everything that happens. It is hardly surprising, then, that while Apache storytellers agree that historical tales are about the events recounted in the tales, they also emphasize that the tales are about the sites at which the events took place. If the style of Western Apache historical tales is relatively unremarkable, their context is just the opposite. Without exception, and usually in very graphic terms, historical tales focus on persons who suffer misfortune as the consequence of actions that violate Apache standards for acceptable social behavior. More specifically, agudzahi stories tell of persons who have acted unthinkingly and impulsively in open disregard for Apache custom, nde bi ate, and who pay for their transgressions by being humiliated, ostracized, or killed. Stories of the agudzahi variety are morality tales pure and simple, and when viewed as such by the Apaches as compact commentaries on what should be avoided so as to deal successfully and effectively with other people, they are highly informative. For what these narratives assert, tacitly perhaps, but with dozens of compelling examples, is that immoral behavior is irrevocably a community affair and that persons who behave badly will be punished sooner or later. Thus, just as agudzahi stories are about historical events and their geographical locations, they are also about the system of rules and values according to which Apaches expect each other to organize and regulate their lives. In an even more fundamental sense, then, historical tales are about what it means to be a Western Apache, or, to make the point less dramatically, what it is that being an Apache should normally and properly entail. To see how this is so, let us consider the texts of three historical tales and examine the manner in which they have been interpreted by their Apache narrators. It happened at Taischo Nasik Ade. Big cottonwood trees stand here and there. Long ago,
The Pimas and Apaches were fighting. The Pimas were carrying long clubs made from mesquite wood. They were also heavy and hard. Before dawn, the Pimas arrived at Cibique and attacked the Apaches there. The Pimas attacked while the Apaches were still asleep. The Pimas killed the Apaches with their clubs. An old woman woke up. She heard the Apaches crying out. The old woman thought it was her son-in-law because he often picked on her daughter. The old woman cried out, "You pick on my child a lot. You should act pleasantly toward her." Because the old woman cried out, the Pimas learned where she was. The Pimas came running to the old woman's camp and killed her with their clubs. A young girl ran away from there and hid beneath some bushes. She alone survived. It happened at big cottonwood trees, stand here and there. Narrated by Annie Peaches, this historical tale deals with the harmful consequences that may come to persons who overstep traditional role boundaries. During the first year of marriage, it is customary for young Apache couples to live in the camp of the bride's parents. At this time, the bride's mother may request that her son-in-law perform various tasks, and she may also instruct and criticize him. Later, however, when the couple establishes a separate residence, the bride's mother forfeits this right and may properly interfere in her son-in-law's affairs only at the request of her daughter. Mrs. Peaches explains that women who do not abide by this arrangement imply that their sons-in-law are immature and irresponsible, which is a source of acute embarrassment for the young men and their wives. Thus, even when meddling might seem to serve a useful purpose, it should be scrupulously avoided. The woman on whom this story centers failed to remember this and was instantly killed. It happened at Tse Chij Da Silide. Coarse textured rocks lie above in a compact cluster. Long ago, a man became sexually attracted to his stepdaughter. He was living below coarse textured rocks lie above in a compact cluster with his stepdaughter and her mother. Waiting until no one else was present, and sitting alone with her, he started to molest her. The girl's maternal uncle happened to come by, and he killed the man with a rock. The man's skull was cracked open. It was raining. The girl's maternal uncle dragged the man's body up above two coarse textured rocks lie above in a compact cluster and placed it there in a storage pit. The girl's mother came home and was told by her daughter of all that had happened. The people who owned the storage pit removed the man's body and put it somewhere else. The people never had a wake for the dead man's body. It happened at coarse textured rocks lie above in a compact cluster. Narrated by Benson Lewis, this historical tale deals with the crime of incest, for sexual contact with stepchildren is considered by Western Apaches to be an incestuous act. According to Mr. Lewis, the key line in the story is the penultimate one, in which he observes the people never had a wake for the dead man's body. We may assume, Lewis says, that because the dead man's camp was located near the storage pit in which his body was placed, the people who owned the pit were also his relatives. This makes the neglect with which his corpse was treated all the more profound, since kinspeople are bound by the strongest of obligations to care for each other when they die. That the dead man's relatives chose to dispense with customary mortuary ritual shows with devastating clarity that they wished to disown him completely. It happened at Nde Da Naz Ine. Men stand above here and there. Long ago, a man killed a cow off the reservation. The cow belonged to a white man. The man was arrested by a policeman living at Cibique at Men Stand Above Here and There. The policeman was an Apache. The policeman took the man to the head army officer at Fort Apache. There, at Fort Apache, the head army officer questioned him. "What do you want?" he said. The policeman said, "I need cartridges and food." The policeman said nothing about the man who had killed the white man's cow. That night, some people spoke to the policeman. "It is best to report on him," they said to him. The next day, the policeman returned to the head army officer. "Now what do you want?" he said. The policeman said, "Yesterday I was going to say hello and goodbye, but I forgot to do it." Again, he said nothing about the man he arrested. Someone was working with words on his mind. The policeman returned with the man to Sibikyu. He released him at Men Stand Above, here and there. It happened at Men Stand Above, here and there. This story, narrated by Nick Thompson, describes what happened to an Apache who acted too much like a white man. Between 1872 and 1895, when the Western Apache were strictly confined to their reservations by U.S. military forces, disease and malnutrition took the lives of many people. Consequently, Apache who listened to this historical tale find it perfectly acceptable that the man who lived at Men Stand Above here and there should have killed and butchered a white man's cow. What is not acceptable is that the policeman, another Apache from the same settlement, should have arrested the rustler and contemplated taking him to jail. But the policeman's plans were thwarted. Someone used witchcraft on him and made him stupid and forgetful. He never informed the military officer at Fort Apache of the real purpose of his visit, and his second encounter with the officer, in which he apologized for neglecting to say hello and goodbye the previous day, revealed him to be an absurd and laughable figure. Although Western Apaches find portions of this story amusing, Nick Thompson explains that they understand it first and foremost as a harsh indictment of persons who join with outsiders against members of their own community and who, as if to flaunt their lack of allegiance, parade the attitudes and mannerisms of white men. So far, my remarks on what Western Apache historical tales are about have centered on features of textual content. This is a familiar strategy, and certainly a necessary one, but it is also incomplete. In addition to everything else, places, events, moral standards, conceptions of cultural identity, every historical tale is also about the person at whom it is directed. This is because the telling of a historical tale is almost always prompted by an individual's having committed one or more social offenses to which the act of narration, together with the tale itself, is intended as a critical and remedial response. Thus, on occasions when Agud Zahi stories are actually told by real Apache storytellers, in real interpersonal contexts, to real social offenders, these narratives are understood to be accompanied by an unstated message from the storyteller that may be phrased something like this: "I know that you have acted in a way similar or analogous to the way in which someone acted in the story I am telling you. If you continue to act this way, something similar or analogous to what has happened to the character in the story might also happen to you." This metacommunicative message is just as important as any conveyed by the text of the storyteller's tale. For Apaches contend that if the message is taken to heart by the person at whom the tale is aimed, and if in conjunction with lessons drawn from the tale itself, he or she resolves to improve his or her behavior, a lasting bond will have been created between that individual and the site or sites at which events in the tale took place. The cultural premises that inform this powerful idea will be made explicit presently. But first, in order to understand more clearly what the idea involves, let us examine the circumstances that led to the telling of a historical tale at Sibikyu and see how this narrative affected the person for whom it was told. In early June 1977, a 17-year-old Apache woman attended a girl's puberty ceremonial at Sibiku with her hair rolled up in a set of pink plastic curlers. She had returned home 2 days before from a boarding school in Utah, where this sort of ornamentation was considered fashionable by her peers. Something so mundane would have gone unnoticed by others were it not for the fact that Western Apache women of all ages are expected to appear at puberty ceremonials with their hair worn loose. This is one of several ways that women have of showing respect for the ceremonial and also, by implication, for the people who have staged it. The practice of presenting oneself with free-flowing hair is also understood to contribute to the ceremonial's effectiveness. For Apaches hold that the ritual's most basic objectives, which are to invest the pubescent girl with qualities necessary for life as an adult, cannot be achieved unless standard forms of respect are faithfully observed. On this occasion at Sibiku, everyone was following custom, except the young woman who arrived wearing curlers. She soon became an object of attention and quiet expressions of disapproval, but no one spoke to her about the cylindrical objects in her hair. 2 weeks later, the same young woman made a large stack of tortillas and brought them to the camp of her maternal grandmother, a widow in her mid-60s, who had organized a small party to celebrate the birthday of her eldest grandson. 18 people were on hand, myself included, and all of us were treated to hot coffee and a dinner of boiled beef and potatoes. When the meal was over, casual conversation began to flow, and the young woman seated herself on the ground next to her younger sister. And then, quietly, deftly, and quite without warning, her grandmother narrated a version of the historical tale about the forgetful Apache policeman who behaved too much like a white man. Shortly after the story was finished, the young woman stood up, turned away wordlessly, and walked off in the direction of her home. Uncertain of what happened, I asked her grandmother why she had departed. Had the young woman suddenly become ill? No, her grandmother replied. I shot her with an arrow. Approximately 2 years after this incident occurred, I found myself in the company of the young woman with a taste for distinctive hairstyles. She had purchased a large carton of groceries at the trading post at Sibiku, and when I offered to drive her home with them, she accepted. I inquired on the way if she remembered the time that her grandmother had told her the story about the forgetful policeman. She said she did, and then went on speaking in English to describe her reactions to it. I think maybe my grandmother was getting after me, but then I think maybe not. Maybe she's working on somebody else. Then I think back on that dance, and I know it's me for sure. I sure don't like how she's talking about me, so I quit looking like that. I threw those curlers away. In order to reach the young woman's camp, we had to pass within a few hundred yards of Men Stand Above here and there, the place where the man had lived who was arrested for rustling in the story. I pointed it out to my companion. She said nothing for several moments. Then she smiled and spoke softly in her own language. I know that place. It stalks me every day. The comments of this Western Apache woman on her experience as the target of a historical tale are instructive in several respects. To begin with, her statement enables us to imagine something of the sizable psychological impact that historical tales may have on the persons to whom they are presented. Then, too, we can see how Agudzahi stories may produce quick and palpable effects on the behavior of such individuals, causing them to modify their social conduct in quite specific ways. Last, and most revealing of all, the young woman's remarks provide a clear illustration of what Apaches have in mind when they assert that historical tales may establish highly meaningful relationships between individuals and features of the natural landscape.
To appreciate fully the significance of these relationships as well as their influence on the lives of Western Apache people, we must explore more thoroughly the manner in which the relationships are conceptualized. This can be accomplished through a closer examination of Apache ideas about the activity of storytelling and the acknowledged power of oral narratives, especially historical tales, to promote beneficial changes in people's attitudes toward their responsibilities as members of a moral community. These ideas, which combine to form a native model of how oral narratives work to achieve their intended effects, are expressed in terms of a single dominant metaphor. By now, it should come as no surprise to learn that the metaphor draws heavily on the imagery of hunting. Stalking with stories. Nick Thompson is tired. We have been talking about hunting with stories for 2 days now, and the old man has not had an easy time of it. Yesterday, my uneven control of the Western Apache language prevented him from speaking as rapidly and eloquently as he would have liked, and on too many occasions, I was forced to interrupt him with questions. At one point, bored and annoyed with my queries, he told me that I reminded him of a horsefly buzzing around his head. Later, however, when he was satisfied that I could follow at least the outline of his thoughts, he recorded on tape a lengthy statement which he said contained everything he wanted me to know. "Take it with you and listen to it," he said. "Tomorrow we will put it in English." For the past 6 hours, that is what we have been trying to do. We are finished now and wary of talking. In the weeks to come, I will worry about the depth and force of our translation, and twice more I will return to Nick's camp with other questions. But the hardest work is over, and both of us know it. Nick has taught me already that hunting with stories is not a simple matter, and as I prepare to leave, I say so. "We know," he says, "and that is all." Here is Nick Thompson's statement. "This is what we know about our stories. They go to work on your mind and make you think about your life. Maybe you've not been acting right. Maybe you've been stingy. Maybe you've been chasing after women. Maybe you've been trying to act like a white man. People don't like it. So if someone goes hunting for you, maybe your grandmother, your grandfather, your uncle, it doesn't matter. Anyone can do it. So someone stalks you and tells you a story about what happened long ago. It doesn't matter if other people are around. You're going to know he's aiming that story at you. All of a sudden, it hits you. It's like an arrow, they say. Sometimes it just bounces off. It's too soft and you don't think about anything. But when it's strong, it goes in deep and starts working on your mind right away. No one says anything to you. Only that story is all. But now you know that people have been watching you and talking about you. They don't like how you've been acting, so you have to think about your life. Then you feel weak, real weak, like you are sick. You don't want to eat or talk to anyone. That story is working on you now. You keep thinking about it. That story is changing you now, making you want to live right. That story is making you want to replace yourself. You think only of what you did that was wrong, and you don't like it, so you want to live better. After a while, you don't like to think of what you did wrong, so you try to forget that story. You try to pull that arrow out. You think it won't hurt anymore because now you want to live right. It's hard to keep on living right. Many things jump up at you and block your way, but you won't forget that story. You're going to see the place where it happened, maybe every day if it's nearby and close to Cibicu. If you don't see it, you're going to hear its name and see it in your mind. It doesn't matter if you get old, that place will keep on stalking you like the one who shot you with the story. Maybe that person will die. Even so, that place will keep on stalking you. It's like that person is still alive. Even if we go far away from here to some big city, places around here keep stalking us. If you live wrong,
you will hear the names and see the places in your mind. They keep on stalking you, even if you go across oceans. The names of all these places are good. They make you remember how to live right, so you want to replace yourself again. A Western Apache hunting metaphor. Nick Thompson's model of Western Apache storytelling is a compelling construction. To be sure, it is the formulation of one Apache only, but it is fully explicit and amply detailed, and I have been able to corroborate